mean, I have a 12-year-old granddaughter.
House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. And colleagues, I'm going to start by carrying over the work session on House Bill 2435 to our next meeting. Do I need to open the work session to carry it over or just announce it?
I believe you just need to announce it, but...
Okay, we are carrying it over. So having given sufficient notice, we'll carry that over and open a public hearing on House Bill 2321. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2321 requires all agencies of executive department to integrate natural and social sciences in decision-making, develop procedures to ensure natural and social sciences are included in decision-making, and include environmental impact statement in every recommendation or report regarding any major agency action impacting the environment. Provides standing for groups or individuals to request contested case on environmental impact statements, provided requirements are met.
Okay. And call forward Christy Split and Tom Wolf, and I believe we'll be joined by Representative Buckley here at some point shortly. Don't worry, Mr. Wolf. Everybody behind you is smiling.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that neither of us expected to be testifying ahead of Representative Buckley. So.
Chair Bailey, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the chair of the Oregon Council of Travel Limited, and I have been studying this bill all afternoon and thinking of what I was going to say in support of this bill, but what I like about it is that it does open some doors, and it, as far as a serious discussion on what we should do as a state in our environmental protection. So I think maybe not necessarily in this form that it's currently in, maybe, but I think that it's a good concept that should go forward. And I noticed from the list there's going to be a lot of people testifying against the position that I have, and. Well, then again, that's not the first time that's happened in this building. It won't be the last. But I think that the author of this bill is very sincere in what he's doing, and I support the concept, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Christy Split. For the record, I'm here today representing the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. It's my first time testifying on a bill in my new job, so everybody enjoy it. We just wanted to get up OLCV and thank Representative Buckley for having an innovative approach to dealing with problems we have regarding environmental protection in the state. And so we identify a problem. We've seen that sometimes the fact that we don't have the agencies communicating with each other in a way that would be more possible and communicating on this topics that are enabled under this legislation. So we just really wanted to get up and support Representative Buckley for bringing this idea forward. We hope it's part of a continuing conversation on how we can do better as we balance development with protecting our natural legacy. And thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thank you. Questions for this panel? All right. Thank you both. Okay. We'll call up Chris Jarmer. Scott Dahlman and Emily Ackland, please. Oh, actually, I'm going to pause you guys and invite Representative Buckley to the stand.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County and the legislature. First off, thank you for your time and consideration of this bill. It's a concept I've brought forward a couple times in past sessions, and I'm sure there are other people who will testify as to its need. I'm supposed to be in the other committee hearing, too, this and another bill. So with your consideration, I'll make just a short statement of support. The basic premise for me, there are a number of states, I think there's 20 states that have a version of NEPA. And to me, in so many parts of our state government, we fail to do the work on the front end, and we pay the price for not doing the work on the front end. And we're constantly trying to get to the front end. We have the whole push now on early learning to try to get to the front end of, can we reach kids early? We have things in public safety. They're talking about, are there ways to keep people out of the prison system? To me, NEPA is simply a way, a tool for us to use as we work on projects in the state to make sure we're doing the analysis that will keep the projects being cost-effective, environmentally sound, that will not lead us to having to spend dollars after dollar after dollar cleaning up what we didn't do on the front end. So to me, it is that basic. The idea of having this for our state is a tool that we can use. I do understand there is an upfront cost by doing this, but I feel that's an idea worth considering. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for the representative? Thank you for making time in your busy schedule. We appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
And now, Chris Charmer, Scott Dahlman, and Emily Acton. Ackland, please.
Nice to use the chair. Mm-hmm.
For the upfront cost.
Two out of three.
All right. That's not bad.
Mr. Chair, members, Chris Charmer, Oregon Forest and Industries Council. Appreciate the time to take. OFIC is opposed to this bill. We have 75,000 Oregonians work in the forest sector. Our members own and manage about 5 million acres of forest land in the state. We feel that the way that the Department of Forestry implements its rules and enforces them is very effective now, and this is just going to add bureaucracy to the system, which will increase costs to both the state and the landowners. I would say I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with the Department of Forestry and the cooperative nature that the landowners have with the Department of Forestry. That history goes back 100 years, predominantly in fire protection, but over the last 4 years also in forest practices. That cooperative relationship that we have avoids problems ahead of time, similar to what Representative Buckley was trying to get at. But we think the system works well now, and the bill will just make it more complicated and less effective, we think. So, and I'd finally like to comment on Section 3. It's pretty ominous looking from a private landowner's perspective. There are a lot of hooks for litigation, and that just increases costs and reduces certainty, and those are both bad things. So, to summarize, oppose the bill. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Ackland.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Bailey and members of the committee. My name is Emily Ackland. I'm the Environmental Policy Manager at the Association of Oregon Counties. The Association of Oregon Counties opposes House Bill 2321. Counties certainly support efforts to protect the environment. We go through all the state and federal permitting. We pay for environmental impact statements and biological assessments, and we do mitigation work. However, you know, essentially this is a state Environmental Protection Act, and counties have a lot of experience with the National Environmental Protection Act. Our experience has been nothing short of added expenses and time delays, so enacting this legislation would be redundant of what state agencies are already doing and place additional costs on counties and deter or at least delay project development. If there are issues that need to be addressed regarding environmental protection at the state level, we're more than happy to work with state agencies on those issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been my observation at the federal level that NEPA slows things down enormously and adds a layer of cost that's nothing short of astounding, not to mention the delay that's then occasioned by the lawsuits that are then brought under any number of different angles. The consequences of NEPA are still playing out in Oregon and elsewhere. The cost would be of great interest. I don't know if either of you are in a position to say how much additional cost, in your opinion, federal NEPA has generated, because it's so broad. It spreads over so many different things, and cost is so difficult to ascertain when we talk about delay. But maybe you can take a shot at it and tell us what we could expect if we adopted at the state level this idea.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I don't really have any idea. I don't work with the federal NEPA law. Thank goodness. That's true for me and my landowners that I represent. So I know just anecdotally those that buy federal timber sales, that process has to go through NEPA, and federal timber sales take years to develop at great cost. That doesn't provide any additional environmental benefit in my mind. So it's huge. You're right. How we would quantify that huge, I don't know.
Chair Bailey and Representative Benz, I concur with what Chris has said. It's very difficult to capture the dollar amounts. I would say I can definitely say that the costs significantly increase for project developers and for counties who are trying to do any work on federal lands. the time delay is what is the significant cost adder, just because of the coordination and time it takes between all the federal agencies. So at the state level, I could say that the time delay would be a significant cost increase.
Well, it's been, again, my experience that at the federal level, the approach that people tried for years was to initiate the action, go through the process, get into the lawsuit, wait, sometimes until it went clear to the Ninth Circuit or further, and then start over again. And then more recently, over the last 5 or 10 years, the concept of a collaborative has been brought to bear, the idea being bring everybody around the table, try to get everybody singing the same tune, get everybody to sign off on the permit, begin the action, only to have someone that wasn't at the table come in, file the lawsuit, and all that work for nothing. And there does not seem to be a method in NEPA, at least, that allows one to get ahead of that process. In other words, there's no requirement that you be at the table in order to file a lawsuit later. Mm-hmm. And so if there's no standing requirement or no device in this bill that forces people to come to those collaborative approaches, there's never an end to it. That's been my observation. And again, I would ask if that's been yours.
Sure. Chair Bailey and Representative Bentz, definitely concur with your observation. And I would also add that, you know, the environmental impact statements are kind of where the crux is. Folks get caught up on the content of those, and then to have to go back and do another environmental impact statement or impact study, again, adds time delays and significant costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, agreed. Good observation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Denver.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just feel like I have to say, as an ordinary citizen, and I'm certainly not an expert in NEPA by any means, or wouldn't even approach that, you know, I think it would probably be erroneous to say that NEPA, or, you know, just the added focus on environmental issues that it represents, hasn't done a lot of good in this country as well. I mean, just last summer I went back to my home state where I grew up, and, you know, the river where I grew up was a stinking mess, frankly. And, you know, now it's become a kind of recreational area, you know, with marina and fishing and things that people can actually eat the fish that are coming out. And, you know, so I think that, you know, we have been obliged to make significant investments in cleanup. And, you know, I think going back to what Representative Buckley said, you know, perhaps if we could nip in the bud some of these, you know, deleterious practices, it will actually save us money in the long run. So, I mean, I think the potential savings by taking care of problems early on would need to be factored in any kind of economic analysis of the cost of doing this work.
Thank you very much. Call forward John Chandler, Roger Beyer, and Sean Gillians, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in opposition to House Bill 2321. And as far as my testimony is concerned, I'd like to do a little bit of a history lesson on why we don't do NEPA in Oregon. The bill would essentially create a state-level version of the National Environmental Policy Act. That was passed in 1969, adopted in 1970. This is the 40th anniversary of Oregon's land use planning system, which is a subject of consternation or celebration, depending on where you sit on that issue. But it was adopted in 1973. So after NEPA was adopted at the federal level, we looked at how to do environmental regulation in Oregon and took an entirely different path than was taken at the federal level. And that's not to say that one is different different, better than the other, although I think ours has worked out pretty well. But I think it's important to keep that in context. This is not the first time we've had the conversation about a state-level version of NEPA, but we made a conscious decision 40 years ago to go down a different path. And I would recommend, Mr. Chairman, not to, to give any more work to this committee, but the Governor's Natural Resource Office has a very good presentation, some of you may have seen in other contexts, on the Oregon Land Use Planning System. Just an overview of where it's been, what it's done, what the successes have been. I'm going to highlight a few of those here, but to the extent you have time between now and the time the committee's closed down, I'd strongly recommend you have them come in and do that presentation for you. It's very well done, it's very thoughtful, and I think particularly for the new members of the committee and those of you who haven't served on a land use committee in the past, it's important to get that reminder of why we do things the way we do in Oregon. And for those of you who aren't land use junkies, I'll summarize very quickly. There's 19 statewide goals, and we decided to take a comprehensive planning approach to environmental protection rather than the regulatory approach that NEPA or a SEPA, State Environmental Policy Act, would have done. Of those 19 goals, there's quite a few of them that deal with environmental issues. There's goal 3, deals with agricultural lands, goal 4, forest lands, goal 5, deals with natural resource, scenic and historic areas, open spaces, goal 6, air, water, land resources, quality, goal 7, natural hazards, goal 8, recreation on the coastal zones. You have a whole bunch of different goals, goals 15 through 19 inclusive. I would not want to take a quiz on the specifics of House Bill 2321, but I do believe that basically what I just rattled off there very quickly in terms of statewide planning goals were, are going to be the topics addressed by this bill should you decide to move it forward, which you certainly oughtn't. The point is, these goals have to be considered by local governments when they do their planning. They have to be taken into account. They have to adopt findings on Goal 5, Goal 6, all the natural resource goals as they adopt their land use plans, both for urban growth boundary formation and for regulation of rural lands uses. And frankly, committee members, this is an extraordinarily successful program when it comes to environmental protection. And we just want to present a couple more factoids, Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence. Oregon has 99% of the forest land, 99% of the forest land that we had in 1630. 99%. In the last 400 some odd years, we have lost 1% of the forest land in Oregon. Now, Senate Bill 100 was not adopted in 1630, but it has had a significant role. And the Forest Practices Act that Mr. Jarmer mentioned has had a significant role in maintaining Oregon's forest resources base. In terms of agricultural land, we've lost 2% of the ag land that we had in 1974 to urban development. Now, it may have gone to other uses, but the urban development, the sort of environmental problems that a NEPA or a SEPA would be inclined to address, we only lost 2%. By anybody's measurement, I would submit to you that is a success story. That means our system has worked. It's done exactly what it's intended to do, to create a balance of environmental protection, economic development, and to do so in a way that was, as Representative Buckley indicated, on the front end. And with all due respect to Representative Buckley, I would submit that we have done the front end planning that he talked about in his testimony, and we did it starting 40 years ago and continue to this day. We don't think this bill is necessary, and in fact, I think would undo a lot of awfully good work were it to pass that has been done in Oregon for the last 40 years. I encourage your no vote should it get to that point, and I'll be glad to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jillians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I will simply just say ditto to Mr. Chandler's comments. I was going to give you a history on the land use system as well and how we... Yeah. I'm certainly, the committee's happy about that fact. And how we do kind of front load where lands are going to be developed, and that's what our land use system is designed to do, exactly the goal of this bill. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Beyer, and happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing a multitude of clients, the Oregon Seed Council, the Oregon Dairy Farmers, the Oregon Small Woodland Association, and the Oregon Blueberry Commission, all of which are opposed to this bill. So the house is full, I guess, when you want to talk about the people lined up in opposition to this idea.
Those are played appendix, apparently.
Yeah. Everything that you just heard from the two previous witnesses and the ones before that, I guess I could just say ditto. I'd like to, for Oswa, highlight again the Forest Practices Act. It's also, I think, 42 years old. It was started in 1971. That, for forest landowners, regulates how we do and what we can do and when we can do it very effectively. We work very well with the Department of Forestry on changes to the Forest Practices Act when science shows they are needed, and has been changed multiple times over the last 42 years. So It works. It's a model. And a few other states have adopted it. I think one thing that needs to be mentioned on the land use side that I didn't hear Mr. Chandler say was that I don't think any other state has adopted our land use system. So whether that's good, bad, or otherwise, we don't have a NEPA or a SEPA. They don't have our land use system. I would argue, and Representative Denbro talked about when he went home. I'm not sure where home was or what river he was speaking of, but I assume it's somewhere east of the Mississippi. And things have changed back there much rapidly than they did back here. But even in Oregon, we do have clean air, clean water, nice soils, everything else. But we did have our problems. We still have some problems in the Willamette. But we have federal acts like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act that have been used to clean up those waterways that needed it without this overburdening state regulation. So with that, I also would be happy to answer any questions. If I could, I'd defer to my experts on the left, on my left, your right, and to answer the technical questions. And with that, thank you, Mr. Chair, for having the opportunity.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Johnson.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I'd hope that Professor Chandler would make himself available to this committee on a as-needed basis for historical context. That was wonderful.
don't call us. We'll call you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure this is the right panel for much of anything, but I'm going to ask this question. The issue is one of federal regulation. You mentioned the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act and federal NEPA and all of this federal overlay that we enjoy in this state. And it seems to me, as we do whatever permitting we go through, the challenge seems to be many times our inability to work with those federal folks. And many times those standards are vague and difficult and unclear because they're at the federal level. So we struggle around at the state level trying to meet them as best we can because we're charged with the job of implementing them at the state level. I wonder what this would add to that already challenging situation because in working the last several sessions in trying to figure out how the state is going to comply with the new higher Clean Water Act standards, one wonders what more could we do to make it even more difficult to comply. So the difficult situations that the sponsor of the bill referenced, I should have asked him about. I should have said, what is it that we are currently doing that's going to result in some problem in the future? And perhaps someone on the committee can share that with me because I should have asked him. But perhaps you gentlemen can say, is there another layer of regulation that would help us make the water cleaner than we're already required to make it? Is there something that we could do at the state level that would make the air cleaner than we're required to already make it? And still be able to make any sort of economic activity go in this state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bench, that sounds an awful lot like a trick question. I think the federal law is sufficient, frankly, for most of the things you've mentioned. And to answer the question you asked as part of your statement there, would 2321 help and make it simpler? I believe the answer would be no.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2321? Not seeing. Oh, we got one more.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Chairman Bailey and members of the committee. I'm Jan Meekums for the record, the State Director for NFIB, and I'd just like to go on the record that we also would have a very difficult time and challenged by this bill, that it would add a layer of difficulty and challenges and compliance, and it's broad, so the interpretation of the bill would be very difficult. And so just for the record, we would oppose the bill, and thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cluding.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, Vice Chair, Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. As I read this bill, I've read it time and time again, but the part that really bothers me is nowhere in here is where 60 elected House members or 30 elected senators have any say-so. And this is what bothers me. You folks are elected because of your merit, your knowledge, and to leave you out of any decision making. Again, this is what really bothers me. So I'll just stop right there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2321. Open public hearing on House Bill 2939. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2939 requires the Public Utility Commission to create a program requiring public utilities that distribute electricity or natural gas to provide reports to customers. Provided reports must compare energy used by a customer to average customer in the area to provide ways the customer can reduce energy use. It allows the customer to request not to receive the reports. It requires the comparison of energy consumption habits of customers receiving reports and those not receiving reports. It allows measured energy savings to be used as an energy resources for energy planning purposes.
My understanding is there is amendment coming. Do we have it yet?
At this point, I do not have the amendment to 2939. Chair Bailey.
Okay. Call forward Rhett Lawrence, Tom Plant, and Jim Capsis, please. Mr. Lawrence, care to kick us off?
Sure thing. Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the Conservation Director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. I'm here today testifying on behalf of more than 20,000 members and supporters across the state. We also have worked closely with other chapters of the National Sierra Club, and happy to come testify, provide some comments to you here today. Oregon Chapter is proud to support House Bill 2939. We believe it's a common sense bill that will give Oregonians the ability to evaluate their household energy use and will provide them with personalized and understandable insights that will help them save money. You'll hear greater detail about the specifics of the program from the other folks at the table with me. But essentially, it would establish a statewide comparative energy disclosure program that will be implemented by the Energy Trust of Oregon in partnership with investor-owned utilities. And wanted to stress that point, that this will primarily be facilitated by the Energy Trust and should not place any additional substantial additional burdens or costs on utilities. So essentially, this program would provide a report in consumers' bills that would compare their energy usage to that of their neighbors and their other similar households in their area, and provide other tips on how they could reduce their energy usage, based on the patterns that were showing up in their energy usage. And research has shown that providing consumers with this kind of information about how they stack up against their neighbors really does provide an effective tool for motivating a decrease in their energy use. So we believe this program will result in both energy and bill savings for households across the state. And importantly, I wanted to note here too that the program does provide an opportunity for households to opt out of the program if they have privacy or other concerns. So you'll hear much more detail about the program, but the Energy Trust has been running a pilot program in six Oregon counties, and it has shown that these kinds of initiatives work. The projected average savings for a household is about $35 per year, resulting in about $30 million saved statewide every year. It's not a ton of money, but it's not pocket change either, and it's substantial savings for the state. In addition to the money savings, energy saved is projected to be more than 60,000 tons of CO2 annually, which is the equivalent of taking nearly 20,000 homes off the electrical grid. And wanted to point out that a program like this also could take us a long way toward helping the state achieve the governor's plan of using energy efficiency and conservation to address all the future electrical load growth in the state. In conclusion, the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club believes this is a great bill for both environmental and fiscal reasons. We do believe that Oregonians have a right to know how much energy they are using and how they can better manage their energy usage to save money. So we would urge the committee to support this bill, and happy to provide testimony to you today, and now I'll turn it over to my cohorts.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Plant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate the invitation to be here today. My name is Tom Plant, and I'm a Vice President of State Policy for Advanced Energy Economy, which is a nationwide business organization that's focused on advanced energy. So we're not specific to technologies, but we promote policies that will lead us to more advanced energy systems using latest technologies and ultimately leading to a more affordable, clean, and secure energy mix. I also come here as a former state legislator and also a former director of energy office. So I've been in your position where you're trying to figure out which policies are going to lead your state to the best solutions, and also trying to implement programs, much as the ETO does here in Oregon, and I've admired the ETO for many years. And it's for this reason that I'm here very strongly in support of this legislation. One of the challenges I think that we all have is when we talk to people about energy, and you're on the Energy Committee, so I imagine you do this frequently, we realize that there's really not a context within which people have an opportunity to really understand energy. If you go out on the street and you talk to people about, you know, how many miles per gallon does their car get, they'll be able to tell you. Or how much does a gallon of gasoline cost? Or what is a gallon of gasoline? They'll be able to answer all those questions for you. But ask them what a kilowatt hour is, what a BTU is, how much they cost, maybe how much their refrigerator uses in a year, and you'll get blank stares, because there isn't really a context within which to understand these concepts, and it's not something that we really deal with on a day-to-day basis. And that's one of the real advantages of this legislation. The comparative usage reports help to put this into a context where people can understand, is what I'm using normal? Is it low? Is it high? I don't, you know, what can I do in order to do things better? And not insubstantially to save money. And so it's a very valuable service for people, and it helps in a variety of different ways, this building of energy literacy, particularly around program implementation across the board. So you actually learn more about, as you're thinking about energy, you're actually learning more about the different programs that are out there. You're more likely to take advantage of those programs and ultimately help you reach your goals of increasing energy efficiency and conservation, as well as the other goals of the ETO. You get to a good sense of how you're doing, but you also have an opportunity to learn how that bar is changing over time, and it certainly does. Just as with cars, what was once considered efficient is now, you know, at the lower end of the efficient scale. It's just because technology changes, as it does in every environment. And so this foundation of energy literacy really helps to enable that dialogue that we all see between a utility and a consumer, as opposed to the monologue that we're kind of used to of the utility speaking or delivering power to the consumer. We have an opportunity for the consumer to start to engage in that dialogue in demand response, in energy efficiency, in different distributed generation choices and things that they may make. And also it lays a foundation for new technologies to come along that are being designed really to try and emulate some what we've all come to know as a sort of an app environment, you know, where applications are being constructed that'll meet consumers' needs and they can engage in that. Right now, there was an Accenture study that came out last year that estimated that the average individual thinks about utilities or their energy use about 9 minutes a year. And so you guys have already like just blown the curve out of the water just in the hearing that you've had here today.
Sadly.
But it's understandable that people don't have a context under which to understand this. And so that's what these sorts of usage reports can lead to. Finally, the other observation that I'd make is that these really help to tie together a number of different efforts that the state is engaged in. whether it would be distributed generation goals and clean energy goals or efficiency goals or conservation goals or even low-income programs. And when I directed the Energy Office in Colorado, we were in charge of the Federal Weatherization Program. It's a fantastic program and really helps people who are living at the margins, where these decisions of how much they spend on utilities can make a big impact in their life. We did a really very strong analysis of these programs, and we would be able to get about 40% reductions in energy use, but we'd spend between $3,500 and $4,500 per house in order to achieve those kinds of reductions. So $4,000, a 40% reduction. What we see with these comparative reports, while they're not replacements for those kinds of things, we also see that these can, you know, a smaller increase, 3 to 5% maybe, can be accomplished with just a $10 a year kind of an investment. So it's a huge bang for the buck. And it also, as I said, engages the consumer in a way that they aren't currently engaged in these programs. Generally, when we would deliver weatherization services, we'd go to the house, we'd do the retrofits, and then we'd say goodbye. And so the relative impact that you can get with these usage reports and the engagement of consumers is actually increased when the consumer is in a home that has been weatherized. So you can actually multiply that impact with that target household. And so with that, I will hand it over to a colleague here from OPower, and he can tell you about sort of some of the technological sides and the experience that they've had around the country.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Capsis.
Chairman Bailey, committee members, thank you for having me here today. I'm your entertainment, and I'm going to try to get this PowerPoint going here.
That was actually Mr. Chandler earlier.
So, round two, sorry. All right, can we see everything there? Slideshow. Just wire on this kind of space. Here we go. Beginning. Perfect. Thank you. Fantastic. So I've got about 10 minutes here, so bear with me. So my name is Jim Capsis. I'm from a company called OPower. We're an energy efficiency software company. I lead our state and federal policy work, and very happy to be here with you all today. My purpose here today is certainly OPower. You'll see why I'm very supportive of this bill, but I really want to provide sort of context for you all from a technical perspective, from a company, one of the companies in the market that delivers this kind of report, this kind of service to customers today, and has been doing it for the last several years. So it's in that context that I'm here today and happy to take questions as we proceed. OPower was founded with the idea that sort of there are two problems, and Tom touched on this. One is if people really aren't getting particularly great information about their energy use, and two, it's not put into a context that's useful for them. And so that in the last 5 years, we've grown a business on this concept, and I'll show you a bit more about the product. But we're working with 80 utility partners in 30 states and 6 countries. We're about 300 employees and growing every day because there's a lot of appetite for what we're doing, which is helping to engage customers to help them save energy and money. Just to show you a little bit of where we are today, we are working with not just utilities, but with third-party administrators like the Energy Trust of Oregon here, and we've been running a pilot program for the last 2 years, and I'll walk you through that a little bit later. But I just wanted to show you, we're really all over the country. We're in all different kinds of states with all different kinds of folks. You know, we're everywhere from, you know, Florida to New York to California, Massachusetts, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Oregon. So it's the kind of this type of information, as Tom was referencing, you know, really does have an appetite out there and does work. So let me talk a bit about sort of this issue we have with energy information. It's confusing, and I think Tom alluded to this as well. You know, when we started the company, I think the first idea was, and no offense to our utility friends, but bills, sometimes because they're heavily regulated, they don't really have a lot of useful information on them, or certainly not information people can really understand. So most of us find it somewhat confounding. We get our bill, we pay it, we don't think about it again. It's also really boring. Energy information, you know, for most of us, you know, in this room may be more exciting, but for the general public, not the most exciting thing in the world. So how do we get them to sort of engage in something that's not normally top of mind? And so one way to do this is to make it relevant, right, for folks. And so what we have done at O-Power based on behavioral research is show people how much energy they're using relative to other people in their local vicinity in similar-sized homes so that they have an actual peer group that they're looking at. Now, this is all anonymous. It's not like you're finding out what Bob next door is using, but it's an average of households that are of similar size in your neighborhood, so you can get a sense of, wait a second, how am I doing? And then that motivates you to want to use potentially use less energy, and I'll get to that in a minute when I show you some of these actual reports. But you can see the three-bar graph here. You would get this, and folks who are in the pilot program here in Oregon are getting it now. It says how you're doing, and then shows you where you are relative to your neighbors, efficient or inefficient, and then you get to get these over time so you can see how you're doing. You can track progress, and that's sort of an important piece for folks so they can see what kind of progress they are making. And this is not that unusual in the sense that maybe the idea applied to energy is a little bit innovative. We certainly like to think so. But if you think about recycling, there's a reason why you put recycling bins in front of the house, and it's not just because so people can pick it up. And there's a reason why it's very colorful, and it's a reason why often they're open. People go outside and put the recycling out, and they look to see, how much stuff the guy next door has. And there's been research done on this that shows people will go back in the house and then try to fill out that recycling bin because not because they're going to get anything from recycling more, but it makes them feel better. So this is a similar principle, right, with which you can engage people in energy, which is also a positive thing for society and helps people save money. I'm going to just step aside here and hand a couple of these things out.
You can give it to the...
You can start with...
These are like a month.
I just can't see your fingers.
The
he must
get some fingers.
I'm lock and load territory.
So this is a pretty big screen. So the reports I brought, just in case you couldn't see this, but sometimes having it in your hand is easier. Just quickly, you've seen the three-bar graph, but the purpose of the three-bar graph is actually to get you to start thinking about things you can do in your home, right, to use less. And some of these are common sense. They're things like what your grandma or your mother told you, which is turn your lights off more often and adjust your thermostat when you leave the house for the day. Or it could be taking advantage of an offer from ETO to put insulation in your house. You can see the example here. This is a real report that's implemented by Energy Trust, but in partnership with Portland General Electric and Northwest Natural. So I want to talk about results here briefly. I think they sort of speak for themselves, but I did want to walk through them for you. And mind you, this is just our one company and what we've been doing so far, and there are others who do this. We're saving on average right now between 1% and 3% per household per year. And you can see in 5 years, we're now, as of just a few weeks ago, we've exceeded 2 terawatt hours in savings. That's like taking a city the size of Sacramento, California, just completely off of the grid. And so we're pretty proud of that. And that's more than $200 million in bill savings in people's pockets every year that otherwise, frankly, a lot of it would just be wasted, right? Because a lot of us leave the house and we forget to turn the lights off. When you multiply that by millions of people, it really adds up. Another nice feature of this type of program, because it's based on information, everybody has an address. You can send everybody a piece of mail. There's a reason why, I'm sitting in a political crowd here of folks that run for election. There are very few political consultants that would tell you, whatever you do, don't send direct mail, right? It works to engage people via the mail, and everyone can benefit. So what you're seeing here is that whether you're a low-income household or a high-income household, you're having virtually the same percentage savings. And that's unusual, because if you talk to folks who run efficiency programs where you have to get people to actually go and participate in something or pay for something, have an outlay, it's very hard to get to reach low-income population. But every member of the low-income population and every senior citizen, as you'll see in a second, can get access to this information to just give them the tools that they need to make choices about their energy that maybe they're not making. It doesn't force them to take a choice, but just gives them the information and gives them the ability to make a more informed set of decisions. And as you can see here, it's also equally impactful with the senior citizen community who have a less number of choices, right? They have fixed incomes. They're not going to spend the dollars they have on installing an expensive new piece of equipment, but they could use some help on just, you know, on an informational basis. I wanted to show you what we've been doing so far in Oregon for the last couple of years with the trust, with a pilot that's been, let's say, successful. It reaches 60,000 households in a number of counties in the state. It's both providing information on gas and on electric usage, and it saved in 2012 about $1.6 million in bills for customers. So that's not bad. It's a good start. You know, very pleased with how it's going. But there is a lot more that can be done, and a lot more that's happening elsewhere in the country at a much larger scale, and I can tell you a bit about that. I also wanted to just show that you heard from Rhett that there's the ability to opt out. I think this is really important, which is it's important that people get this automatically, because if they don't, as we said, this information tends to, energy is sort of boring, people aren't that engaged, but if you send this to them, they actually will engage and they will change their behavior, they will help themselves out by saving money, but you got to give people the option to not get this information. Not everybody wants it. But what we've found is that very few people actually opt out of the program. So you can see both the ETO average and our average across dozens of deployments throughout the country. It's about 1% of folks decide, you know what, this isn't for me. Take them out of the program. They don't need to get this anymore. So their control and privacy is protected. So I'm just going to leave you with a sense of what's possible. And then happy to answer questions. If this type of information, again, whether provided by us or someone else, was delivered to all households cost effectively in Oregon, it would save $30 million a year in people's bills. So that's not, you know, that's not an insignificant amount of money in people's pockets. So let me show you what we're doing today. With ETO, we're saving about 9 gigawatt hours on the electricity side. That would move up to about 220. On gas, it's about 300,000 therms, and that would go up to about 4 million. And on utility bills, you've seen this before, 1.6 million so far, and we could do 30 million. Give you a sense of where else this is playing out at a larger scale than what you've seen in Oregon so far. In both Massachusetts and in California, each state has more than 1 million households receiving this information, saving a combined $60 million a year. And Rhode Island is actually rolling this out this year to every single household in that state. And there are other examples, but those are a couple notable ones. Let me stop there. I'm happy to answer technical questions about either our program specifically or more broadly. I appreciate your time and consideration for this bill.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm sure we have a number of questions from the panel. I'd like to start out with one, though. I want to clarify a comment that you made, Mr. Lawrence. In reading the bill, it appears that you could interpret it that the utilities are implementing this program were it to pass. Sounds like that's not the intention of the bill, and that it's to make it in investor-owned utility territory through the Energy Trust. Is that right?
Chair Bailey, that is correct. Yeah, the Energy Trust of Oregon would primarily be facilitating this arrangement, so shouldn't impose any significant cost on the utilities.
And why can't Energy Trust of Oregon do this now on its own? Why is this bill necessary?
Chair Bailey, I'm not sure I know the specific answer why they can't do it. I think the savings we have seen in the six counties we've the pilot program, spreading that out to the remainder of the state, to maximize the energy and financial savings statewide. It just seems to me it's a no-brainer, something we should be doing.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Whitsitt.
Could someone describe to me where the money comes from in the Energy Trust of Oregon, the origination of the dollars in the trust?
The dollars through the Energy Trust of Oregon come from a public purpose charge assessment. I'm not sure that these gentlemen are quite the experts on the public purpose charge.
Okay, yeah. So does that ultimately come from the ratepayers?
Correct.
Okay, so in effect, the ratepayers would be paying for this service through the Energy Trust then?
Perhaps you might discuss where the funding comes from to implement the program through the ETO pilots that you've been running, if that would be helpful.
I think it's right. I think, to my understanding, it is through the public purpose charge. I mean, it's from the ultimately from the ratepayers. That is accurate. I think that the point that I would make, which is true really of all energy efficiency, but particularly that cost effective energy efficiency, is that it does pay for itself, and so that the benefits of the program exceed the cost. So in the case of this program, what that means is. It costs somewhere around $10 per year per household for this program to be delivered, but households are saving about $30 a year on their bills. And so, you know, from an investment perspective, that's a pretty good return on your investment. And for our program in particular, which is, again, because it's information-based, it can be sent out very quickly to very large numbers of people. And so that those benefits can exceed the costs within 2 to 3 years of the program being in the market. So it's a very fast payback. Does that help answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and maybe you could expand on it a little bit and talk about cost effectiveness here in general and how you see this bill leading to a cost effective outcome.
Sure. I mean, I think as we've seen, I think both in Oregon and elsewhere, as the program runs, in the first year of any program, you are sort of ramping up. You have some, you know, startup costs and have to engage people. But the program improves its performance over time. So each year you're seeing additional incremental savings on top of what was achieved previously. But the costs become fairly flat after that for running the program. And so you're looking at, again, as I said before, a very quick payback. In the context of the ETO program, it was in the second year that it ran, cost effective, meaning the benefits exceeded the cost in that second year. And as we enter the third year, it will be cost effective overall over that whole time period later this year. I would also note that the program in ETO is unique in some respects because it is focused not on, it's focused on average customers, meaning average usage customers. So it's not, sometimes utilities ask us to reach the most heavily using households because there, you know, we can sort of maximize the savings that we deliver to them, you know, from a dollar perspective. However, what we've found is even when it goes to everybody, everybody can save. And so I think that's what we've learned here in Oregon, which is a fantastic learning, at least from our perspective.
Is there anything within the bill that requires cost effectiveness over time for this program?
So I believe that there is an amendment. I'm not sure if it got into the system.
It actually just arrived.
Okay, fantastic. So that amendment focuses very much on making sure the program is cost effective and that a program would not run or be permitted in the state unless the benefits exceeded the costs within 3 years of the act, being put into law. And so the Public Utility Commission, from my understanding, would be responsible for ensuring that that was the case. But I think it's very important, and I would highly encourage not accepting, you know, language in legislation that would not require cost-effective savings, because then otherwise you will get a product that doesn't actually deliver the goods.
Representative Reed.
I think there was a question here. But so the public purpose money comes from the utilities, goes to Energy Trust of Oregon, and Energy Trust of Oregon can do any number of energy efficiency projects, correct?
That's right.
So isn't this just another energy efficiency project? And so back to Chair Bailey's question of why do we need a special law for this energy efficiency project and not insulating somebody's house? I don't understand.
Tom, you want to take this?
Sure. Obviously, it's not going to take the place of insulating somebody's house. It's an additional program that the ETO would be able to deliver. I think one of the things that's unique about this is that it's an opportunity for the ETO to be able to deliver a program at scale. You can deliver this information to all the customers, except for those that opt out. So, as as you've seen, 99% of the customers, and provide them with this information. And a lot of times, people assume that they need to make a substantial investment in order to achieve savings. And you know, one of the things that I was noticing on Jim's slide was that actually, of the three options that were up there, the one that actually saved the most money was the one that didn't cost anything, which was just simply turning down the water heater. And so there's something there for every income group. There's something there for every customer within the territory to be able to benefit from. And so it's very unique in that way. In most efficiency programs that an entity is delivering, there is a requirement that there is some kind of investment up front, either in putting in insulation or in putting in cost-effective light bulbs or whatever it might be. You have to actually go out and buy something. A lot of the options here are absolutely free. It's just a question of educating people about what some of these options are. As I said, they don't really have a context under which to think about those things.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to say at the beginning, it's from my perspective, I really don't care what my neighbors use, and I really don't think it's any of their responsibility to monitor what I use. But having said that, I get that there's opt-outs and stuff. But on my utility bill right now for my Hooter Electric Co-op, they give me a year-over-year comparison with the kilowatt hours I use this month with what it was for the same month the previous year earlier. Same thing on my water bill. I can monitor that already, but I'm the control. It's not my neighbors and so forth, because there's so many variables in a utility bill. Obviously, the square footage, the type of year of construction, the floor plan, the how many freezers do you have, how many hot tubs do you have. There's all kinds of variables to where I would think it'd be hard to get a good controls that out there. But my question for you would be, what kind of science do you really have to be able to equate that this pilot is being effective in lowering the 1-3%? And could it not also be influenced by, let's just say, the vast preponderance of counsel and input that we receive from so many sources throughout our whole society that tell us to drive less, eat less, breathe less, so we'll lower our carbon footprint? We're just bombarded with that stuff. How can you point to this program and say that it is cost effective, that it is accomplishing really anything that you can point to and quantify?
Mr. Vice Chairman, fantastic questions. I've asked the same questions myself before I joined O-Power 3 years ago. I put up a slide it's not there. I'm sorry. I have a slide, but I'll just describe it since it's no longer connected for some reason. We run what's called randomized control trials with all of our programs, meaning there is always a group of folks that are receiving the program and a small group who are statistically identical who are not. So this is the way that, in science class in middle school, you ran an experiment and you did a group that was a test group and a group that was a control, and you looked at the results to see what the impact was. The Food and Drug Administration uses the same approach for testing pharmaceuticals. So we actually have had, there it is. We've actually had this program independently verified more than 20 times now. And it's actually one of the largest experiments of its type because of the number of households that we are engaging, in the millions. And so otherwise, if to actually identify 1-3% savings is very hard statistically unless you have a very, very robust experiment and control group. And so we pride ourselves, at least as O-Power as a company, on the rigor with which we are measuring these programs. And in most cases, most commissions require that there be a third party that does the evaluation. We have a sense of what the results are as well, but it's validated by an outside party. So as an example, you see a couple here, but the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, has what's called the State Energy Efficiency Action Network, C-Action Group. They put out a report about a year and a half on best practices for measuring and verifying these types of programs. We follow that gold standard, which is a randomized control approach. Happy to provide any of that information after the fact, but I appreciate the important question.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much for the presentation. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Actually, I had a question.
Sorry.
And I think Ben does as well.
Representative Dimbro.
Thanks.
Sorry. The hands.
Yeah. I have a kind of a technical question.
So, you know, a concern that I have is with people who live in apartments and who are, you know, in many cases captive to whatever the state of the energy efficiency of their units and their building is. So I wonder, how do they fit into this? I mean, how do they benefit from this? And are there programs that would really help them to either be perhaps to better advocate for themselves or to inform the landlords or to alter their behavior?
I'll answer based on my experience at OPAR. Tom and Rhett might have other experiences that are outside of sort of the framework that we have. The apartments, if you're a renter and you actually pay a bill that's based on how much energy you use because that unit is metered, right? This program can help you in the same way it can help others because it will be based on your actual usage. So I mentioned the results that we've had with low-income customers. When we send information to low-income customers, we don't send them offerings to take up really expensive programs. We give them no-cost or low-cost tips and suggestions that they can take because otherwise it's not relevant to them. And that's the problem with a lot of efficiency marketing is generic, right? And so that's why it's not relevant for folks. So I think the answer, at least where that information is available, is customizing it to the point that you can by giving them things they can control, like, you know, behavioral things only, like changing lights and thermostat, et cetera, or putting in weather stripping or light bulbs. But you wouldn't tell them to put in insulation because they don't own the building. But I wonder if some of my partners here on the panel might have some other experiences.
Well, no, I think the point's very well made. The other aspect of this, and to Representative Johnson's point, is that certainly the energy use in an apartment is going to be much different than, you know, a single family home that's 3,000 square feet. And that's one of the important things I think about the comparative. It's not you know, Jim down the street is using this much and you're using this much. It's a home that is similar. So another apartment building that is of similar size and content is using this much, and this is how you compare. Just to give people a context under which to understand that.
I don't think I have anything to add to that.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just trying to make sure I understand the nature of the concept and why we would engage in it. Is the cost, again, de minimis of doing this, the cost of this sheet? I think you mentioned earlier, given the information that already is being created by utilities, actually generating this is how costly? Have you kind of told us?
Yeah, it's about $10 a year per household to deliver the program, and typically from a efficiency standpoint, that's about 3 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour avoided from, you know, at least from the, on the electric side.
Okay. And follow up. Sure. Follow up.
Yep, follow up. Thank you.
So the question is, it's almost like a neighborhood scold sort of a deal. You're not doing quite as well as you should be doing, therefore you could be doing better, and some of your neighbors are, and so forth. So get hopping and go down to Home Depot. I'm not saying that's bad.
Yeah, or throw it away. But yeah.
Right. But I'm just trying to figure out the technique of sharing with just you, basically. No one else is going to know about this, where you stand. Right? I mean,
that's correct.
You see how you stand vis-a-vis your neighbors, but they don't see this.
Exactly.
Unless they search your garbage. And so
it's in those colorful recycling bins, actually.
That's right. Yeah, right. Exactly. Nice. I'll give you an anecdote. So my cousins used to live in Rochester, Minnesota. And Rochester Utility is one of our clients. And I told them, we're at, you know, I was working at this company, OPower, and this is what we do. And he's like, wait a second, I get one of those reports. I was like, oh, great. He's like, I went to my neighbor and I were in the yard, and told him about this report. And he's like, oh, I got that one too. And we got it out, and we started talking about the reports. And then my neighbor felt so he was so concerned that he was doing so poorly relative to my cousin that he did go to Home Depot and purchase a bunch of stuff to make his house more efficient. Now, does everybody do that? No. But that's the whole point. It goes back to what Tom was saying before. People don't spend a lot of time thinking about energy. It's just not something that's present. It's invisible for most of us, right? And so does it have a little bit of, are we nudging you a little bit and giving you information that makes you, you know, maybe makes you feel, oh, I don't feel that great about myself, maybe? Yeah. But the truth is it gets people to engage on something that matters, not just to them, but to the broader society, because it's a heck of a lot more inexpensive to get people to use less energy than it is to build new generation. And that's why we built the company and sort of the mission that we have. But, you know, the point about opting out is important. And there are people, to be frank, who don't like it. But overwhelmingly, we've gotten a positive response, or I don't think we would be where we are in terms of the scale that we've reached.
Thank you.
Representative Whitsitt.
Okay, thank you. How do you determine your geographic areas? You define this as geographic areas. Do you use the census, census blocks, smallest geographic unit for the Census Bureau, which tabulates 100% of data? Then you have census block groups, which are clusters of blocks with populations 600 to 3,000. Census tracts. Permanent statistical subdivisions of counties, 4,000 people and greater. And so how is it that you propose, or how do you divide up geographically your comparison regions?
Sure. So the way OPower does it, again, it's one company that does this, is we create 100, typically 100 square mile radius. That might vary in a more rural area, and we're looking at households that are similar to yours, meaning they're a similar square footage, and they have a similar energy mix, meaning you don't put a person into a peer group with electric heat and someone with gas heat, because it would just look very different. And we are using census data that's publicly available to determine those different comparison groups, as well as other data we have, in particular the energy usage, which is why we partner with utilities and or, in Oregon's case, the Energy Trust.
Okay. I have just one last question,
please,
and then I'll... it seems to me that you would reach a maximum efficiency in short order doing this if you keep sending it year after year to the same people. What do you expect to achieve after you go out, say, a year or two, and the people who are interested in the program are involved with it? I mean, you're going to reach just a terminus pretty soon on it. So do you keep those people in it? Do you keep sending the stuff to them? Have you looked at what your calculus looks like on that?
We certainly have, and happy to share. I don't have a slide on that, but happy to share it with you after this hearing. So, yes, we've seen over the first 3-4 years that the program is in market, it is increasing in terms of the rate of savings, with the steepest spike in the first and second year. And then what we're seeing is savings are maintained and slightly increase over time. So as long as you're running the program and people continue to receive the information as you suggest, folks continue to save. So you do not see a deterioration in savings. It's not like people get this for a year, and then the second year they're like, you know what, I already know this, and I'm going to ignore it. They actually sustain that savings, and the control group stays in place, and so that you're able to see over time that savings continues.
Okay. It just seems like you would approach, the savings would approach the cost.
What I hear you, if I might clarify, what I hear you saying, I think, is that the rate of increase slows but doesn't go back down.
That's right. However, the cost effectiveness is based on the ability to continue to deliver the savings over time. So the program costs what it costs in order to both generate the savings and to continue the savings over time.
Okay.
Is that
Kind of? Kind of. I mean, I see where eventually the cost does not,
Justified by the savings.
Right.
happy to take this maybe offline.
Okay, sure.
So that's a question that sort of, you know, regulated environment, you know, comes up, and the program has continued to be approved over time as it goes, because the way that these programs tend to be evaluated is, as long as you're generating savings and delivering, you know, based on costs, it's not like, I guess I'm trying to figure out how to describe this. As long as, the benefits keep outweighing the costs, because if you stop receiving the information, I think maybe what you're getting at is if we just turn this thing off, we stop sending information, people would stop saving, right? I mean, because it's the information that you're engaging with them that gets them to use it.
And
because a lot of it's behavioral. Exactly, that's right. And so maybe this is the question you're getting at. So there are results that have been independently verified at this point with a couple of different clients, different places, that show if you were to stop providing this information over a period of a couple years, you would see a deterioration in those savings. Now, there are people who will also, as Tom mentioned, install some of the things that he otherwise would not have installed because they're getting the information. And that savings would stay. But, you know, it's like the kid... This may be a bad analogy, I'm going to use it. It's like the kid who goes to college who, when they were at home and their mother nagged them every day, don't forget to turn the lights up before I go home, and then you go to college, you're like, there's no, you know, I'm not remembering anymore. Again, maybe not the best analogy, but you stop, you know, keeping the lights, turning the lights off.
Perhaps I can offer an alternative analogy, and you can tell me if it's right. Hold your jokes, but I'm currently trying to lose some weight, and I've got my calorie counter on my iPad, and I've got my scale at home that I step on every day, but on those days when I don't do it, a little extra brownie or two, wouldn't you? It kind of slips in there somehow, you know, a couple extra bites. It's hard to remember and keep myself honest when I'm not tracking it.
Yes. Sure. I would add, and I think that the cost-effectiveness component that's been proposed is an important piece here. One of the other things, and we've talked about this, but one of the things I'd like to reiterate is that, you know, the Energy Trust of Oregon has a number of different programs, and they're marketing those programs to people all the time, as they should be, and so people are making decisions all the time. They're getting marketed these things, and they're making decisions. One of the great values of this is it gives them the information with which to make an informed decision that they maybe otherwise wouldn't have. And I think that that's an admirable thing for as a baseline to provide to consumers, is the information under which they can make a more informed decision about the things that are being proposed. And so I think that that's another benefit of this program that I wouldn't want to forget to mention.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. And I might take the prerogative to say that for those of, I think it's actually only two of you, maybe, that have been on this committee for a while, you might recognize Mr. Plant's name having been invoked in vain a couple of sessions ago. He was the inspiration for a lot of the work that we discussed in the committee around restructuring energy planning in this state based off of some of the work that he did in Colorado. So thanks for continuing to give us lively debates here in Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Call forward Marion Haynes, Gary Bauer, and Scott Bolton. Whoever would like to start, please go ahead.
All right. Thank you. Chair Bailey, committee members, for the record, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. We serve about 560,000 customers as Pacific Power across Oregon. In the O-Power slide showing their clients across the nation, we show up a couple of times. We've been doing business with them on a trial basis in Utah, Washington. Our sister company, Mid-American Energy Company, has been working with them in Iowa. Really don't have a lot of concern about the content of the presentations or the value of some of the themes that were expressed earlier. Certainly, the idea of growing our customers' energy literacy is something we should all be supporting. Giving customers good access to information to help them make energy choices makes a lot of sense. Our objection to the bill really rests with, I think, Representative Reardon's question, which is there's a lot of different options out there in the marketplace. This legislation basically would put in statute something that should be happening commercially, that we're about to embark on a trial here in Oregon through the Energy Trust to test this concept with our customers in September. And there's a pretty robust process in place with the Energy Trust, the Public Utility Commission, and the utility as a partner to evaluate if this is a good tool, if our customers like it, and if it should be deployed on a wider scale or not, or if we have to look at other tools as well. So this just seems a little heavy-handed, maybe premature to be mandated, and good idea, but this is probably not the right way to make it happen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Marion Haynes. I represent PGE. We represent about 825,000 customers, mainly in the northern Willamette Valley. I would echo a lot of what my colleague, Mr. Bolton, said. PGE agrees with the concept behind the legislation, which is to say that we agree our customers should have an ability to know how much energy they're using, that personalized data is very helpful for customers and especially can help drive things that could help them save in their energy bills. That being said, we do oppose House Bill 2939 and are also, I think, maybe a little perplexed at the need for this piece of legislation at this time. PGE is in a trial with O-Power using this program right now. That has not yet run its course. We're still evaluating the data, looking at whether this is the most cost-effective way that we can drive savings for our customers. The other thing that I would note is that we also have a tool available on our website called Energy Tracker that customers can use. It has personalized data that has recommendations that link to little pop-ups to the ETO where there are incentives available based on the personalized recommendations that they're receiving. So given that we are seeing that there's a lot of different tools out there, that we're evaluating the best way for customers to access this information. I would also note that while not overwhelming, when we do hear from customers about this program, some of them do tend to be a little hot about it. I think there's some privacy concerns and some concerns about the comparison there. So for all these reasons, again, we also agree in concept. The idea of providing good information to customers is excellent, and we're happy to play our part in that role, but just don't see the need for legislation on this at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural, and we're a natural gas utility serving around 600,000 customers here in Oregon, from the Gorge down the coast to Coos Bay. As was mentioned on the slide, we are a participant in the pilot that's being undertaken through the Energy Trust of Oregon. As has been said, the results still are not in. They're coming in. We're still in the process of evaluating it. And at this point, it seems a little premature to legislate something that we're still trying to study and analyze. As to working with customers, just like the other utilities, we provide a lot of information, both ETO-related, which are programs that they could purchase energy assistance through or energy efficiency through, but we also send out information that's free. I mean, basically, how to turn down your thermostats, how to turn down your hot water heater. If you think your equipment's not operating correctly, we actually send technicians out to look at that and help them find someone. So your furnace isn't operating correctly, we'll help connect you with someone to repair that. So, but again, back to the legislation. Just think we ought to run the course with the pilot first. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions for this committee? Representative Whitsitt.
I just wondered, how many households are there in Oregon that would qualify for this? And I don't know if the panel knows. I'm just trying to get a sense of, at $10 a household, what we're looking at as an expenditure from the Energy Trust of Oregon. You have 600,000 and you have just...
Yeah.
Check my notes, Representative. Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, for our pilot for Pacific Power that's scheduled to begin in September of this year, the pilot will run for 2 years and include approximately 15,000 customers.
Okay.
And that'll be a sampling of customers
right.
across the state.
I was looking for sort of a total number of households that, if we pass this as a state law, that are going to be affected.
I don't have the answer for that, but I bet that we could come up with
that'd be great.
An estimate.
Thank you.
It would at least be all the IOU customers in the state.
Sure.
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, we have on the residential customers about 730,000 out of the approximately 825,000 total customers. Some of those would be overlapping with Northwest Natural.
Right.
Representative Benz.
Oh, sorry.
Well, sure. Bailey, I was going to say the other way you could look at this, maybe from the electric standpoint, and they can correct me, but I think roughly two-thirds of the population or households are served by investor-owned utilities, give or take a few percent. So, and that's basically the ETO footprint.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this, I have to say I'm worried about the customer with low self-esteem, and this could have a major impact on someone with a bad day. But I want to know if there are other means of effectively communicating the fact that you could do something else with your house. I mean, this goes right to the 2,651 square feet, and the, is it possible that you can send people a letter and say, gosh, you know, we look at this, and in the great scheme of things, instead of comparing to the neighbor, you instead compare to the options, or is it that neighbor element that drives it? I see heads nodding going back. So it's that fear of the neighbor or keep up with the Joneses thing. So I guess, Mr. Chair, to get to a question, the psychological nature of the device leads me to wonder what else you guys could be doing to study up on your customers and tell us what else might work better than this. I understand the result, but the way we get there seems interesting.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, we test a number of different programs to try to talk to our customers, reach out to our customers, and provide this kind of information. I don't know that we believe currently that comparisons to neighbors is the best way to drive some of these savings. We do offer lots of other tools, as I mentioned, Energy Tracker online, which we rolled out about a year ago to residential customers and just in December to commercial customers, that has lots of detail and best practices and very specific data that you can enter about your appliances and things at home that will provide you personalized recommendations. And we've seen in just the first year of that rollout a huge amount of customers going on to that website, about 100,000 out of the 825 in the first year that we rolled out, going and clicking around and finding out what they can do. So I think there are many different tools out there, and I think what we've all been saying is we're in a trial. This is a good tool we ought to be looking at, but I don't think that at this point we can say that it is the one that we ought to be mandating that will drive the kind of savings that we're all hoping we can get in the system.
It is a utility bill envy. That's what it is, isn't it? I mean, seriously. It would be interesting to see what alternatives there are, but I can understand the psychological nature of it. It just seems, I'm not sure. But your pilot project will tell us if it works for people in the Northwest, at least.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, that's what we're waiting to find out. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd just follow up on Representative Johnson's question earlier. For the other tools that you have, do you go through the same kind of evaluation protocol to measure savings on how they're working, like with Energy Tracker and that sort of thing over time?
Chair Bailey, absolutely. We, any new program, we have to put together a business case and you know, show that it's going to make sense for customers, provide value. So we go through extremely rigorous review of the types of programs that we put in place for our customers.
Thanks. Representative Reed.
Does O-Power have any more information about their customers or their consumption than any of the utilities?
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon, probably O-Power could answer that, but my guess is through our participation and that of the ETO, that's the totality of the information, or at least the inputs. Certainly their software, their methodologies are proprietary and part of their business, and they can speak to that, but the customer information, the billing information is absolutely coming from the customer's utility.
Mr. Capsis, did you want to address that question?
Just from here.
You'd have to come up to the microphone and reintroduce yourself on the record.
This is what we do as a business, and so that's the focus of everything we do, is to engage customers on their energy use. And so because we're working with 80 utilities and reaching millions and millions of households, we have, I would say, learnings from working in multiple jurisdictions over time in terms of what works. In terms of, do we know more about the utility's specific customers than they do? We partner with utilities or ETO to use that data to help them deliver something that they would like us to deliver, which tends to be this engagement tool and savings. So we're bringing sort of a data analytics approach, and we have software engineers, you know, that typically utility does not have at their disposal to deliver that type, this type of service. There are also obviously other vendors they work with who also have software engineers, but I would say that's the maybe differentiator that we would bring.
Paul? So is it safe to say then that if the utility saw the value in your services at some point, they could just hire you directly instead of using their own internal communications?
In other states, that's the case. I think with Pacific Power, as you've heard from Scott, we are working with them in a number of other jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. But in those jurisdictions, it is the utility rather than the energy trust that has responsibility for energy efficiency. Okay. And so that's why Oregon's a little bit unique in that sense.
Okay. It just gets confusing when you go back between energy trust and what I get when I'm reading my energy bill at length every month.
Nice.
Really good.
Sympathize.
Triangular relationship. Representative Whitsitt.
So I assume that you have a database by name and by address that continues over several years for every household that is within this footprint of the ETO. And so I'm still trying to figure out maybe 1.5 million people, households.
Within Oregon specifically or nationally?
Yeah, what we're talking about here is Oregon and a law that would affect...
Let me just make sure I understand the question. The question is how many households will we be able to reach?
And will you have a database with a name and an address that you will keep year over year? You've obviously got something in a computer, right?
Sure. And we are what's called SOC 2 certified, which is one of the highest sort of data protection standards that's sort of in the market, and follow what's called privacy by design, which is a very rigorous approach to privacy that, frankly, not very many companies put in place, because our clients are typically public entities, right? So we take data protection extremely seriously. If there is a case where we no longer have a client, we then no longer have the data. We give that data back to, we no longer have authorization to that data, and we only have data for the purpose of serving our clients, and we cannot do anything with the data, if I'm addressing the question you have, then provide the service that we provide. And what I mean by that is we cannot turn around and sell that data to anybody else or use it for any other purpose other than to provide the service that we provide for utilities and for third-party implementers. To specifically answer your question, as many households as would be cost-effective for us to reach, if that were the will of the legislature, we would have access to that information in the same way that the utilities currently have access. We would, what's called a contracted agent of either the ETO or another jurisdiction, the utility, which means we have to follow the same laws of data protection as they do.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Seeing no further testimony on House Bill 2939, we will close the public hearing. Anything for the good of the order? Seeing nothing, committee is adjourned.